Redacted Media and GhostHat.net present The Film Illogical Society. On today's episode, we continue our countdown of the BBC's 100 Greatest Comedies of All Time. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Scholes and Chad Halverson.
And welcome to another exciting episode of the Film Illogical Society, the countdown show, with your hosts, Chris Scholes and
Chad Halverson,
where we break down the top 100 films of all time, according to the BBC.
Oh, I should probably pull up that list.
Yeah, it's an important list. Good. It is an important list. So this is number 78.
Oof.
78 is from 1987. The film is The Princess Bride.
Never have heard of it, have you? Audience.
No. Directed by Rob Reiner. So this is the first son of another director, I believe, that we had. Because Carl Reiner directed The Jerk, which was around number 100 or so.
Oh, yeah.
So this is Rob Reiner, his son, who started out as an actor and worked his way into directing. And is a very accomplished director. Now, I mean, he's just as accomplished, I would say, as his father.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll talk more about them. You don't have to. I know your notes are in order, so I apologize.
Your notes are shut up.
They are. That's exactly what they say. Yeah, I'll show you.
On the top, it says shut up.
Yep. On the bottom, it says Chad. So it's really very complete. My notes. So this is a very popular film. I think it's 32 years old now, 1987.
Yeah, 2 years ago, Kate and I actually went to the 30th. They did a 30th anniversary tour, and they stopped in Milwaukee, so they showed it. And then they had a Q&A with Carrie Elwes at the end of it. So that was cool.
What movie did you talk about?
Oh, we talked about the first Saw.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
It's like one of his most famous roles ever.
This movie also stars Christopher Guest. This is our second Christopher Guest film.
Whoop, whoop.
I believe we have another one.
Yeah, Best in Show's on the list, right?
I think
it
so.
It better be.
It also has some very memorable roles from Mandy Patinkin, Wallace Shawn, Andre the Giant. Mm-hmm. Chris Sarandon is in this film. He plays Prince Humperdinck. And I learned from watching this film that he is also the voice of Jack Skellington.
Not the singing voice, because that's...
Not the singing voice, right.
That's what's his face.
That Danny Elfman.
Huh. I didn't know that.
But he did the talking voice.
Interesting.
He just couldn't sing. Yeah. Also, a very memorable role for both Billy Crystal and Carol Kane.
I love Carol Kane.
And one of the first roles that I think we saw Robin Wright in.
Yeah, because I think even at the end of the credits, it was and introducing.
Yeah, and I believe she may have been like a soap opera actress or something like that before The Princess.
That doesn't count. Come on.
But this was like one of her first like big films. So, or it was her first big film.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, as we do with every show, Chad,
yes.
Why don't you provide a nice condensed, synopsis of the main storyline?
I mean, I can provide a synopsis that's nice, but I don't know if I can condense it, but here we go. All right. So, the beginning opens up with a kid. He's sick. Played by the wonderful Fred Savage.
Side note, question for you. Mm-hmm. Have you ever read the book?
No, but I'm interested. After I saw the Q&A with Carrie Elwes, like, they actually talked about the book a lot. And I always forgot that it was based off a book only because I really haven't watched this movie. I mean, I really didn't watch it for the first time until like 10 years ago. So I didn't grow up with it. So I'm losing a little street cred here, but anyways.
Okay. So, sorry to interrupt. We'll talk more about the book after your synopsis.
Yeah, fuck you. Okay. So, Fred Savage is sick. All his friends are outside playing, and he's stuck inside, and his mom invites his grandfather over to read him a book, or he gives him a present. He opens it. He's like, it's a book? Bah! You know, it's the equivalent of a millennial getting a book today. Like, children hate books. So, the grandpa is like, you know, hey, this story was read by my dad and his dad, and now I'm going to read it to you. And it's called The Princess Bride. So it starts off with this beautiful young woman that lives in a little farming community named Buttercup. And her, was her horse, farmhand, that's what it is. I was going to say horse. Farmhand. I was going to call him a horse maiden. That's not right. So in the beginning, Buttercup just, you know, sort of teases the farmhand, you know, asks him to do all these mundane tasks, and every time she asks him to do something, she's like, oh, farm boy, a farmhand. And every time she asks him to do something, he says, as you wish. And as time went on, Wesley is his name, he realizes...
Westley.
Yeah,
that's better. There's a T in there, you know.
Yeah, I know. But they say it so fast, it's like saying Tim Apple. The cook's in the middle. I just said it so fast you didn't hear it. Anyways.
That's true.
So yeah, Wesley realizes that as you wish is really saying I love you, and Buttercup realizes that he loves her. So they get together, all in the first like 3 minutes, everybody. Like it just goes really quick. Like they're in love, like
wait,
boom.
Wait a minute.
What?
Is this one of those kissing stories?
Oh, man. You know what? I was going to queue up some Deadpool stuff from the re-release of Deadpool 2. But I did not do that.
It's okay. You don't know.
Okay. So, yeah, it is a kissing movie. In the beginning, they kiss, and essentially Wesley needs to make his fame and fortune, you know, to support him and Buttercup, so he leaves. And word comes back a few years later that Wesley died, and
womp womp.
Yeah, and Buttercup is, you know, she's like, all right, well, he was the man I love, so I will never love again. And fast forward to a couple years later, Prince Humperdinck of the local town, or what should I say?
Florin. He's the Prince of Florin.
Florin, it is Florin. Prince of Florin, as the 100-year anniversary, is it 100 years? 200 years?
Something like that. Yeah, we'll say 8,000 years.
Yeah. Their kingdom's been around for a fuck ton long time. And the prince is going to marry a commoner, or a common person, as a celebration. So he chooses Buttercup. Buttercup agrees, but she's really apathetic and she doesn't care. Whatever. So Buttercup's on a ride.
Whatever.
What? No, she's like, what? Literally, she's like, I don't fucking care. She's like, I don't care. I'm here. Whatever. I mean, she probably realizes she has a better living situation, but as far as, like, actually loving Prince Humperdinck, it's not happening. So she goes on a horse ride. It's one of her daily rituals just to make her feel alive. And she gets kidnapped by three men. The leader, who's played by Wallace Shawn. Indigo Montoya, who is kind of like a fencing genius. He's like the fighter. And then Fezzik, who's the giant. They kidnap her. And right off the bat, it seems like they're being followed by somebody. So they keep going, and the person's getting closer and closer. They end up climbing a mountain, and the person's climbing up the mountain right behind them.
Cliffs of Insanity.
The cliffs of Insanity. I can't do a good Wallace Shawn. Like,
No one can do a good Wallace Shawn except for, of course, Wallace Shawn.
Vizzini, his character, he tells Inigo to stay and, you know, fight this guy.
Well, first he says, inconceivable.
Well, yeah. I figured we... I don't want to give away all the good jokes. You're telling me to tell all the good one-liners, Chris.
Right. Well, I'm the one adding flavor. You're adding the base. I'm adding flavor.
Oh, okay. You're the flavor.
I'm the flavor.
The flavor adder. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and right away you can tell Inigo is, he's, you know, a scoundrel, like sort of a Han Solo. Like he's only working to get revenge for his father's death. And you find that out because he ends up talking with the masked person. Who, yeah, by the way, it's just a guy in black wearing a black mask. Obviously, well, it's Wesley, but, you know.
Well, it's the Dread Pirate Roberts.
Well, the Dread Pirate Roberts, but, you know, you're a Dread Pirate Roberts.
I am on
fire tonight.
You are.
So, yeah. They have a sword fight. Inigo is great, but he's bested by Dread Pirate Roberts. So then the next challenge is fighting the giant. He fights the giant. And he's not killing these men. He's laser focused on what he's supposed to be doing, which is apparently getting a buttercup. He finally gets to Vizzini, who's pretty much conceded that, like, hey, you're bigger than me, you're faster than me, I can't beat you, unless it's a game of wits. So they do this poison challenge, essentially. If Vizzini can pick the right one, you know, then he won't die. And through a comedy of errors, Vizzini ends up drinking the wrong one and he dies. It ends up being that both the drinks were poisoned and the Dread Pirate Roberts had built an immunity.
Smart guy.
Smart, super smart guy. Not super smart about how he hurt himself on set, but I'll get to that later. Anyways, so it's at this point, Wesley kind of confronts the princess, or at least he gives away that it's him, and she figures it out, and now they're, oh, you're not dead. He's like, nope, I totally cheated. I met the Dread Pirate Roberts. He apparently wants to continue the franchise, so he just gave it to me. Like, apparently the Dread Pirate Roberts is just a story told over time, and it's just been different. It's like Doctor Who.
You know? Well, I think they actually do kill people, but they find a replacement. And
yeah, they're still pirates, but they're not. Yeah, they're still bad. Pirates. Yeah,
yeah, they're still bad. They just save some people.
Yeah, the people that they like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they go through what is the Fire Forest? See, this
the
is
Fire Swamp.
Fire Swamp. Thank you. So this is where I'm going to get beat up because everybody I know is like, oh, it's called this, and I've only seen it.
RUOSs?
RUOSs, I do remember that. The Rats of Unusual Size. There is a
rodent.
Oh, rodent. My God. Oh, my God.
I mean, it's like we didn't do any prep for this show now.
Listen, I watched it yesterday, and a rat and a rodent could arguably be considered the same thing.
I would say a rat is a rodent, but a rodent is not necessarily a rat.
Oh my God. Ugh. All right. So he fights a rodent of unusual size, burns it. It's great. And stabs it. They get out of the forest. Prince Humperdinck. Oh yeah. The whole time Prince Humperdinck has been following the trail of the princess, and he's a hunter. So he's like telling all his soldiers, like, oh, there was a fight here, and the winner went this way, and he's all, like, super proud of himself, and typical royalty.
Yep.
So, they finally catch up with Wesley and Buttercup. They're gonna kill Wesley, but Buttercup sacrifices herself and says she'll marry Prince Humperdinck if she lets Wesley go. Prince Humperdinck's like, yeah, sure, babe, no problem. And then immediately is like, no way. We're going to put him in the, Pit of Despair?
Yeah! Come back.
Yes! So they keep him in the Pit of Despair. Buttercup doesn't know. And they essentially make a deal. Well, Buttercup thinks she made a deal with Prince Humperdinck. Like, hey, send your three fastest ships out. Bring Wesley back. I'm really in love with him. And, you know, that would be the best wedding gift of a wedding that I'm not going to do. You could, you know, do for me. And he's like, of course. But really, he's trying to marry Buttercup to kill her to start a war?
Yep, he wants to start a war.
Yes. So she doesn't know that it's a whole one of those like, hey, nobody really knows what's going on.
Well, that's not the important part. I mean, the important part is he wants to start a war, blame the murder of the princess on the enemy.
Yes.
So that he can fight. That's kind of like the secondary. Like, I mean, it's a.
Yeah, it's not the A line.
Yeah.
But it's still a contributing factor to why he has to get married so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So after Humperdinck realizes that, like, you know, she's never gonna love him, and you know, she's not being a good fiance that he forced into a marriage. You know, like we've all been there, right, guys? No, okay. So he ends up killing, I guess only half dead, but ends up killing Wesley. And it's at this
mostly dead.
It's at this point we catch up with Inigo and Fezzik, who find out that the guy who killed Inigo's father had six fingers on one hand. So he's constantly looking for the guy with six fingers. Well, the guy with six fingers is
the right-hand man of Prince Humperdinck.
Yes, literal right-hand man. So Fezzik lets Inigo know. Inigo's like, we got to go there, but I'm not smart enough to pull off such a thing because there's going to be guards everywhere and blah, blah, blah. So, like, we need to find the man in black. They find Wesley. He's dead.
Mostly dead.
Well, we don't know that at first. And even Fred Savage is like, what? But Grandpa?
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Good point.
It's like, do you want me to finish the story, Chris?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
So they get Wesley. They're like, all right, well, we got to try something. So they bring him to Miracle Max. Max used to work for the king until Prince Humperdinck was a dick and kicked him out. And they figure out that he's mostly dead. And at first he's apprehensive. He doesn't want to do it. But then
because he was to blathe, which means...
To blathe, yeah. but it was for true love. So nothing's more noble than true love. So Miracle Max, with a pushing from his wife, performs the miracle. The only problem is it takes a little bit for Wesley to kind of get back to his senses. So they get to the castle. Wesley is conscious, but he can't move. So they come up with a trap to get inside of the castle. They don't get there in time. Like, technically, the marriage is finished and Humperdinck brings Buttercup to his room. Buttercup goes in the room only to find Wesley is... in there, laying down on the bed. Still can't move, but he looks really suave and badass. Humperdinck comes in, they have a confrontation, and eventually he walks away. Or he doesn't walk away, he just... what am I trying to think of?
Well, he doesn't want... He's kind of a chicken coward who doesn't want to get hurt.
Yeah, but so, he surrendered. Thank you.
Yeah, he's threatened by a very prone Wesley, and decides, you know what? Not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out.
Yep. So Wesley and Buttercup are united. Inigo finds a six-fingered man after being maimed and tortured by him a little bit. He gets his second win, like he Hulkamanias, like Hulk used to do in the ring. Where he's like, he gets back up and kicks his ass, kills him. And then all four of them, Fezzik finds horses, and they all ride into the sunset. And then that's the end of the book. Fred Savage has a nice moment with his grandfather, like, hey, Grandpa, you know, you can come back over tomorrow and read me the book if you want, or, you know, like, whatever. You know how we don't like to hang out with our parents, but we secretly do?
Grandparents are different.
Yeah, they are. You're right. Either way, it was a cute moment, and at the end of it, Peter Falk just turns his shoulder and says, as you wish. And that means I love you, because we learned that from the beginning. Movie over. You're welcome.
Roll credits.
God, I feel like that was like a 30-minute synopsis.
yeah, about. Well, let's break it down a little bit. So, I will say this was one of the first movies that I remember, like, seeing early, first run, basically in the theaters, like, and enjoying it, like, walking away and enjoying this film, even then, and because I feel this film brings so much, you know. I mean, it is what the grandfather describes. You know, there's romance, there's sword fighting, there's everything to make this film to be popular for both boys and girls. Mm-hmm. Because it's a children's story, but it's also for people who are children at heart. Like it really brings you back.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the performances were spectacular. I mean, I think this is Cary Elwes's best performance in any film I've seen him in. He's not a very much a working actor. He's been the star of a few films, but you know, he's not one to like be a Oscar nominated type actor.
Whatever.
This is one of the first films I've ever seen Mandy Patinkin in, and I can't say I've seen a lot of Mandy Patinkin, but Inigo Montoya is one of the best characters I think I've ever seen on film. Just you know, you have his whole motivation, you have everything you need to know about him done so well, and he has one of the best lines of the film and maybe of all time. The you know, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. And he just keeps going. And of course, Andre the Giant. Some casting. So this movie was originally going to be made in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
With a different director.
Yep.
And the director wanted, or the director and the author, William Goldman, wanted to get Andre the Giant for the role, but he wasn't available. So they were going to cast instead a little-known actor from Austria named... Sorry, there's a weird sound going on outside. Named Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
The film never worked out, so when Rob Reiner got the rights to the film and worked with William Goldman on a screenplay, they were finally able to get Andre the Giant, who was very hurt, very injured during this. He had just gotten done with back surgery.
Mm-hmm.
He's a big guy. He's a really big guy. And
well, I mean, he always had, like, not growth developments, but because he was so big, like, his body, I mean, no human was meant to be that big.
No, I mean, he had gigantism.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and I think the film had to use stunt doubles so often. You know, and there's some that are funnier than others when you see that they're stunt doubles, like at the end riding in the horses.
Because they're probably like the same height as all the other actors.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a smaller actor that's definitely the horse, because, yeah, it's like that's not Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
But he couldn't physically, he could not hold the weight of Robin Wright or Cary Elwes for different scenes. So they had to use camera tricks and ramps and ropes to hold the weight of those actors, because Andre the Giant physically could not hold up more than his own weight.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch this film, most of the time he's leaning on something or has a hand on something or has something kind of like a cane in front of him, although it's never, you never actually see an actual cane or whatever. So it's interesting how they worked around his condition.
Can I add to the injury list?
Yes, I was trying to set it up for that, yeah.
Oh, were you going to tell the one about Carrie Elwes?
No, no, I was going to let you, because you had said in the synopsis, I'll get to that later. So yes. I was letting you get to that later.
Well, fine. Do later. You know the story?
Yeah, but you can go ahead.
Oh, Jesus. Well, Chris, fine, I'll tell it. Sorry. I'm very combative with you today, and I don't mean it. I don't know. I love you. So,
as you wish.
Because Andre the Giant couldn't walk everywhere or, you know, try to stay off his feet, he had a four-wheeler on set that he would use to get around, you know, anywhere. And it was somewhere in England they were shooting, right?
Yeah, it was Britain, England and Ireland.
Yeah. And, I mean, those are all scenic places with, you know, huge tracts of land.
And old castles. Yeah. And it's perfect setting for this type of story.
Yeah. So he kept bugging Carrie Elwes, you know, he always called him boss. He called everybody boss. He was like, hey, boss. You know, and I can't do French because it's whatever.
Hey, Andre. Boss.
Hey, boss.
Hey,
boo-boo.
Hey, boo-boo.
So he coaxed him into finally riding it. And, of course, the first time Carrie rides it, he busts his shit and he busts his leg.
Foot. That was foot.
Which is on. Attached to.
Anyway.
Anyways, so you can see in the movie where him and Buttercup are finally together, and there's the point, it's like a wide top-down shot, and there's like a rock, and I never knew until I heard this story, but like, you can see him, he kind of like hobbles, and then he like sits down, like going one leg dominant first, and like with his hand back, and he sits weird. That's because that was the day he busted his shit, so... Everybody was hurt on this freaking set. And it's weird, like you were saying, the fact that Andre the Giant's character had to carry, you know, so many people in the script. You know, it's crazy good how they hid the fact that he really couldn't.
Yeah, and I mean, it's amazing in many ways that, you know, that he was able to actually, I mean, when you learn more about his injury and what was going on, it's amazing that he was actually able to do that.
Yeah.
Because this is someone, yeah, that you're right. Like, he had all sorts of health problems. And there is an amazing documentary on Andre the Giant's life out there that I would highly recommend. He was such a literal gentle giant.
Yeah.
Who was cast into the role, and you know, he had much success as a professional wrestler, which somebody that large, it makes sense. You know, and this is the film where he struck up such a strong friendship with Billy Crystal that Billy Crystal wrote a film dedicated basically to Andre the Giant that was supposed to star him, the two of them, talking about their friendship, called My Giant.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you ever saw that film, but it stars a very tall basketball player.
Oh, yeah.
George Mirasan. But that was supposed to be Andre the Giant. And it was all about, yeah, how Billy, you know, I mean, it's they're playing characters in it, but it was their friendship that had formed. So you know, I mean, it was a highly impactful film as far as just that, and just to kind of, you know, he was over 7 feet tall, Andre the Giant. Mm-hmm. He weighed, I mean, he was 6'3" by the time he was 12.
Man, if only.
Which is crazy. Yeah, I mean, he you know, he died at the age of 46.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very young. Heart failure. I mean, he was just so big that his heart was not able to keep up.
Yeah, that big, that long.
Yeah, I mean, he was 7 foot, over 500 pounds. Again, it's amazing that he was able to do what he did. So I want to talk a little bit about the book. So this was the book was written by William Goldman as well, But both the book and the film credit the writing to S. Margaret Stern. Okay? So,
is that a pen name?
It's a pen name for William Goldman. So they both, what I found fun, so I read the book, and I had to double check to make sure that the book wasn't written after the film,
mm-hmm.
because they did a very good job of adapting the book into the film. So it starts out with the same premise where it's William Goldman writing that, like, he writes an introduction saying, when I was a young boy, I got sick, and, you know, I was on my bed. I couldn't go out. I couldn't play with my friends. And my grandpa came in, and he read me this book. He read me the unabridged version of the book, though.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about the story of all this work that he did to try to find this book again. that it was a lost book, that no one had heard of this until he found this small little bookstore, and he was able to find the copy. And it's just this amazing tale that he does. He made all this up. He made all this up. This is all part of the story. It's all kind of just setting the story. And, you know, really the biggest differences between what we saw in the movie and what was in the book is as always, like, the book has more. Like, the book, you get more into Buttercup.
Mm.
You learn more that, you know, her parents and what they were doing to kind of push the royal marriage. You get more into the background of Vizzini and Indigo and Fezzik. Like, you learn that, you know, where Fezzik came from. You see Inigo when he's a little boy and interacting with his dad and, you know, all he did to learn how to fight. So it gets a lot of that, but it's really, I would highly recommend, if you're a fan of this film, I cannot recommend the book higher. Like, it's an amazing read. And it's funny again, cause there are points where William Goldman interjects in the story and says, well, this is where they start listing off all the supplies in Florin that they'll be using for the wedding. I'm going to just go ahead and skip this part for you so you don't have to read it. You know, and stuff like that. Like it's really funny and just a well-done, enjoyable book. It's written in 1973. So if you're looking for something to read or listen to, because, you know, you can get an audiobook.
Yeah, it's more my jam now.
Yeah, I would recommend it. It's a very fun read.
Can I bring up the thing I hated about this movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hated, with a capital H, the music. Like, the synth keyboard with, like, the fake horns. It's such a good story. It doesn't need to be Lord of the Rings, but I don't know, man. It just kind of—I don't know. What do you? I don't know. I hated it.
So this was 1987.
Yes.
No, it had a relatively low budget even for that time. $16 million was the budget for this film, which, for a period piece, is pretty amazing. I mean, you consider, you look at all the actors that were in this, and Billy Crystal was a name. Carol Kane was a name, and they basically have cameos.
Yeah, I mean, they probably all got paid scale.
Yeah, but everybody else was kind of, not a top actor. I think the lead singer for, Mark Knopfler. He was the lead singer for Dire Straits.
Yeah, yeah.
He did the music for it.
Yes.
So,
which sucks because I love Dire Straits.
Why? The I do like the end credit song.
Well, yeah, but that's your typical 80s, like,
yeah.
Hey, this is the end of the movie.
I'm not saying that the music was great. I'm not. And I agree with you. Like, it's very synthy. But I think that's more of a something of the era and something of a way to save money.
Oh, it, no, it definitely than is anything a money-saving tactic. Like, I
yep,
get
but, it. But I agree with you. It kind of, it you know, but unlike some films, like, this has such a strong story that the music can be bad.
It can.
You know, and I think there's stories that are much weaker that can, you know, that the movies are ruined by bad music then.
I agree. It doesn't actually ruin the movie. It just... It's definitely reflected that it has a low budget, and I almost years later, I would just love, like, play the same everything. Like, you can have the same progressions, the musical beats. Just, man, hire a 10-piece frickin' orchestra, man. Not even, like, just sneak it in there, see if anybody notices.
So you're saying George Lucas it?
No. Because George Lucas would change the story, or he'd change the music. This is more of like a remastering the Beatles' White Album for the 18th time and buying it again.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah, I think as a film itself, I mean, as a family comedy, this is fantastic. I do love the premise that this is a story being told, and yeah, I mean, there's a reason why Deadpool 2 for the re-release went to this kind
went
of
to the pool, yeah.
Yeah, went to the feel, like it's I know there have been many other films that have given the same premise of we're reading a story, and here you all look at the story is becoming visual now. Disney was like that with all their early cartoons, mm-hmm. And Winnie the Pooh and stuff, and countless other films. So that's not a new concept, but having that kind of the grandfather reading and becoming the narrator. And by the way, the grandfather played by Peter Falk is also an amazing casting.
Yeah.
Some of our older fans may know him as Columbo. Some of your newer fans or younger fans probably don't know him, but Peter Falk, very good actor, very good, very neat voice, very unique voice.
Oh yeah, like it's. I mean, Morgan Freeman wasn't available, so.
I don't think Morgan Freeman was in acting at this point.
No. Well, not famous acting, but I will say that this is one of those movies. Like, even though I didn't see it until much later in life. Like, I definitely know, I think this is why it's such a cult classic, is it's not like a horror movie cult classic where it's a very small group, or it's not like a strictly comedy cult classic, which would only put it in a specific group. This movie is comedy part fantasy, you know, part love story, so it's got such a wide net, and so many people have seen it, you know... It's really hard to argue that this movie is bad. Like, it's just a very good execution. Yeah, there's some mess-ups, but hey, man, like, fuck. Everything nothing's perfect. So
it is a very approachable film.
Yeah, it's just easy to digest.
Yeah, and you could have it on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just do whatever, and you could jump in. Every scene is a good scene. There's no wasted effort.
Yeah.
The movie flows well. You know what's going on, and you don't need like you as a viewer, you know, when you see the Dread Pirate Roberts, you know that's Wesley. You don't necessarily know the story, but you can figure out pretty quickly that's Wesley.
Yeah,
they're not hiding it too well.
They put a mask on him and give him a mustache.
Right. I mean, the only one that would recognize him out of all the people that were there would have been Buttercup, but she's 5 years removed, and she thinks he's dead. So, you know, it's not going to be an easy thing. So, yeah, it's a very approachable film. I think it very much deserves to be on this list. I think we can add The Princess Bride to the Filmological Society Countdown Show seal of approval.
Oh, we should get a stamp made.
We should.
For a podcast.
Like hit our monitors with it.
Yeah, and then nobody will be able to see it.
Well, we won't. Well, we won't be able to see the monitor after a while.
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah, I would... This is a film, if you have not seen it, you should. It still holds up, even though it was made in 1987. You know, I mean, obviously some things look different. It's not as crisp looking as today's films. But it definitely, the story holds up. The acting holds up. The synth music doesn't take away from it, but I do agree with your point. But it is a story that I think can be enjoyed by everyone.
Can I just say, just, you know, just hopping ahead, because I know we'll preview what we're watching next. I read the logline for our next movie.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, anything else for Princess Bride?
No, like, it's okay. People got to watch the movie. Like, I don't think I've ever met a person who hasn't liked this movie. So if you haven't seen it, watch it.
So that was number 78. Number 77, we go back to Italy for the film named Divorce Italian Style, a 1961 film directed by Pietro Germi or Germi. Chad, what would you like to say about it?
A married Sicilian baron falls in love with his cousin. Just going to leave that there. Like, you don't even need to know the rest of it. I'm already in. Let's see this.
Well, I mean, right now it sounds like it could be Game of Thrones.
Yeah, that's true. I haven't watched Game of Thrones yet. So, I forgot cousin knocking boots with cousin was back in.
There's lots of good family love in that story. And vows to wed. I'll continue for you. And vows to wed her, but with divorce illegal, he must concoct a crime of passion to do away with his wife. So I've not seen this film before.
Neither have I.
I will watch this with my wife, who speaks fluent Italian. But we'll see, because it may be too the Sicilian accent may be too much for her. So we'll see. We'll see. So that's our next film. Again, 1961's Divorce Italian Style. All right. Any last thoughts?
Nine.
Nine of them?
No.
That's German. Not
Italian. Nine. Brooklyn 99. It's a good show. You should watch it.
It is. Yeah. It is. You know what else? Lord loves a working man. Don't trust Whitey. See a doctor and get rid of it. And watch Princess Bride if you haven't already.
And
you need to.
And rats of unusual size. You're welcome.
Rodents.
The Filmological Society is a production of Redacted Media in association with Ghosthead Media. For more information, find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, or visit us at www.ghosthead.net.